Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. If African literary traditions are inherently transnational and multilingual, like Gustavus colleague Dr. Martin Dakalako has written, then African literature ought already to be understood as world literature, circulating readily across languages, territories, and reading communities. And yet, African literature is only infrequently referenced in discussions of world literature. Dr. Dakalako joined the Gustavus English Department in our African Diaspora Studies and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies programs in the fall of 2021. An expert in Anglophone African literature, African feminisms, and African studies, she received her BA in literary studies from the University of Texas at Dallas and her PhD in comparative literature from the University of Oregon. Her Gustavus courses include African digital literatures, African feminism, African postcolonial literatures, world literature, Black worlds, and Black comics. Along with teaching, she is an active scholar with a published essay on Namibian Facebook serial fiction, a chapter in a book titled African Women and Their Networks of Support, Intervening Connections, which she co-edited, and other work under consideration for publication. Her scholarship also includes numerous academic conference papers and invited talks, both in the U.S. and abroad. As all this suggests, Professor Ndakalako's teaching and research are enriching the Gustavus curriculum, which is to say students' education, in important and fascinating ways. And I've been eager to speak with her on the podcast about all that, as well as her personal story. So Dr. Ndakalako, Martha, welcome to Learning for Life. I'm so delighted you could join me.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Greg. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks. We've talked at River Rock, the local coffee shop in St. Peter, and you're a fan of coffee, as am I. So that's been fun. So welcome again. Yeah. Now, are you teaching today, or what is your teaching schedule this semester?
I teach spring semester. Yeah, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Okay, me, that's what I'm doing too. Yeah. I like to start with people's backgrounds often. Because you came in the fall of 21, we were already in person, right? Or were you doing hybrid at that point because of COVID? That's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, no, we were in person, but we were masked. Okay. So a lot of people were still doing online.
Okay. Yeah, I've been trying to ask colleagues and students what it was like to be online, but that's right. You and I, but I'd gone back to the classroom too with a mask. Yeah. Are you still doing masks now, or how are you doing it in the classroom?
Yeah, I'm not masking, and I'm not either. Yeah, and I'm not really asking my students to. They're welcome to. And I actually, I haven't addressed it, but I probably should address it.
I have not addressed it. And I'm not masking. And I'm seeing students, some of them, oh, that's you. Oh, my God, without a mask for the first time. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, that was the strange thing about 2021. Like, all my students were masked. I was masked. And then I see them in the spring of that year, and I don't recognize them.
No, same here. Isn't it weird? It's amazing. It's quite interesting about how much we rely on the, on the face to recognize people.
Yeah.
The whole face, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, we'll talk about this later, I hope, but one of the things I did do as a result of what we've learned from COVID was I teach hybrid now. So on Fridays, my classes meet online, partly because I want a close-up of their faces. I insist that my students have their cameras on, and so I have a close-up of their faces. And also, I want to take advantage of some of the things that we learned in COVID, even though COVID was terrible. But I think teaching online is something that we should think about a little bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's become a theme of the podcast for you and other colleagues, myself included, where, it's awful, right? We're not saying, hey, it was worth going through this, but it's surprising how much, and I'm talking about myself now too, because I never taught online. I never thought I would do anything online, but what we're keeping going forward from what we learned as a result of having to go online. We will talk a little bit about that when we get into your teaching. So, so why don't you tell us where about your background? That's kind of where I like to start with people. Where'd you grow up? What were your interests as a kid? kid? Were you already thinking at 10 years old, I'm interested in comp lit? I mean, I kind of doubt it, but you know, who knows? You never know.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Namibia, in a tiny town in the south, like on the coast. So Namibia is like, it used to be called Southwest Africa by the Germans.
Well, and it's Atlantic coast on the west. Is that right?
Yeah. 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 Okay. And so, yeah, it's exactly where it is. Southwest Africa is where it's located. And the town I grew up in is Oranjemund. It's like on the coast at the very tip of Namibia. Mm-hmm. And it was owned by De Beers. So I grew up like towards the end of Namibia's colonial era. So Namibia becomes independent in 1990. So it was like the last African colony. South Africa becomes independent in 1994, but South Africa was apartheid, so it's considered different. So Namibia becomes independent in 1990. I grew up around about then, and this is important because Oranjemund was a closed town. Uh-huh. So while all the stuff that was happening in the country, Oranjemund was because it was a diamond mining town. You had to have a permit to live there. You had to have a permit to enter the city.
Wow.
The town wasn't the city. And in terms of interest, I am the firstborn, and my mother taught me to read early on. Gosh, I wonder, I definitely was able to read before I went to preschool. So,
wow. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I loved literature from the start. She would buy me any book that I even looked at. And I have, at some point, she showed me this little collection of books that I made for her.
Oh.
I'm left-handed, so they were backwards in the sense that all the writing was from right to left.
Right to left,
E's,
yeah.
Yeah, the E's, the B's, the 3's, all those things were inverted. Yeah. So
that's really all very interesting. I'll come back to your mom and literature and you in a second. What about, so it's a closed town. First of all, were your parents involved in the mining industry in any way or not?
Yeah, my dad taught the miners English. So he worked in the mines, but as a teacher. And so he worked with the African miners who were coming from all over Namibia, a lot of people from other parts of Africa too, of like Southern Africa, were coming to the mines there. And of course, because they had to speak English. And so, he taught miners. My mom my dad worked for the mine. My mom did not work for the mine. She worked, she had various jobs. At some point, she was a preschool teacher. And then she worked for clothing stores. At some point, she owned a Woolworths.
Oh, my gosh.
Industrious woman.
Wow. See, as a kid, I mean, I don't know what age this might have happened to you. If it did you had a sense of this is a company town or closed town? How aware of you were you of that?
Not so. I don't think, well, actually, maybe more than I would have liked to think. Well, here's why. So every year we would leave Oranjemund and drive up north. So we'd leave the south, you know, like where Oranjemund was, and drive all the way up north to northern Namibia, where my parents are from, like Ovangoland. And to do that, you had to drive through, at the time, colonial Namibia, right? So you leave this little town that's closed off, that's really safe. And you remind me to talk about what Oranjemund was like. So you kind of get a sense of, yeah. So you leave, and then you'd like, we go south, loop into South Africa, and then loop back into Namibia, because that's the way the roads worked. And once you hit Namibia, you hit the border. And then after that, you drive for, you know, a few hours, and you hit checkpoints and checkpoints and checkpoints. And these checkpoints were intense. I mean, they were manned by soldiers, and then we eventually make our way through, you know, to Ovangoland. And then when we were up north, like, and that was like the village area, that was where a lot of the fighting was happening. And so there were curfews, there were tanks of soldiers coming through. So you were very much aware that Oranjemund was a different place than, you know, in terms of like feeling, right? Because it was owned by the mines, because it was protected, it was a different place from the rest of the country. So it wasn't something that was on the forefront of my mind. I mean, you're a kid, you know, but definitely you felt it. And also because of the way Oranjemund was. So
Yeah, say more about that, the town. Feeling. I mean, some people might think, oh, company town, it sounds, I'm using your closed town, sounds oppressive, but you're talking about feeling safe. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll preface this by saying that my remembering of Oranjemund was very much, there was racism there, of course.
Sure.
And there were things that happened that my mom is way more aware of than I was as a child.
Right.
But basically, Oranjemund, we had nice houses, and the town was very much catering towards families and children. So, you have a block of houses and you have this huge park, with, all kinds of playground equipment. The park that was across the street from our house had a huge tank, like in the corner. And it was like this old decommissioned tank that they painted a bright blue that we used to play in. But it wasn't like even like a thing that reminded you of the war. You know, we played, We also played in the trees. We played, I wrote a paper about it. But yeah, we played, in the jungle gyms, the swings, all kinds of things. But that park was famous in Oranjemund. But the town, so I believed in Santa Claus. We call him Father Christmas. Uh-huh. I believed in Father Christmas for years because what the town would do was, come December, you tell your parents, I want a bicycle. Your parents buy you a bicycle. They take it to the city, to the town, and the town wraps it for you. Then a week before Christmas, they have this fair with a Ferris wheel because it's summer for us, right? It's not winter in December. So they have the Ferris wheel, the characters in costume. I don't know if it was Mickey Mouse or whatever. They have that kind of place. And then Father Christmas arrives in a helicopter, lands in the middle of this thing. He comes out with his big bag and his helpers, and then he goes into this place where he sits down and you as children line up and you give him his name and his helpers go and get you your bicycle.
Wow.
And you think, well, Santa exists.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
that's amazing. That's cool. Yeah.
So they did.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So they did stuff like that all the time. It was a great town. I mean, and you got close. It wasn't. It's not a big town.
That's what I was going to ask you next. Actually, roughly 20,000 more?
Less than that. Yeah. Okay. I couldn't give you the numbers. Yeah, I want to say about 7,000.
Even smaller than St. Peter.
Yeah. Oh, by far. Yeah. So people were close, and particularly the Black families were very close.
I assume the town was segregated or not?
No.
No.
So I found out that, I didn't know this, I found this out this last summer when I went home, but so it wasn't segregated. And I wonder if it's because there were definitely changes that were happening. Like the war had been going on since 1966. Decolonization, of course, was happening across the continent.
Sure.
And things were not going well for South Africa. So in 1976, Oranjemund decided to allow Black families to actually move their families there. So before this, the town was white, the houses were there, white people were living in houses, Black people were living in compounds, basically. They worked for the mines, they came, they worked, they went to the compounds. And it was just them, and they didn't have their families with them. So there was, it was part of the migrant labor system. So when they were on vacation, they would just, go home. And to the north, to the northern Namibia or wherever, home was for them.
Yes.
So 1976, the town decides to allow Black families to move into the town. And I found out that my family was one of the first, my parents were some of the first families to eventually, the first five families to eventually move into the town there. Yeah. And so, it wasn't, and as a result, and then they steadily increased the population of Black families there. So yeah, I grew up, my best friend, Zara Lily. Mm-hmm. She'll never hear this. But yeah, she was white. Her dad owned the video store. And so, and my
sister. That's a good friend whose dad owns a video store.
Good. It was fantastic. My mom needs to never hear this, but she would go to work and then me and my brother and my sisters would go over to Zara's house and we would borrow Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, Chucky, you know, all of those like horror movies. And then we'd have nightmares and we couldn't, you couldn't tell my parents like, why are we having these nightmares? Because
what's wrong with our kid? Yeah. They didn't know. Did you have, which reminds you, by the way, did you have siblings? You were the first, did you say?
Yeah, I'm the firstborn and I have a brother and two sisters, but my mom comes from a large family, and so does my dad. So my mom also raised her sister. So she's my aunt, but she's really my sister. I didn't know she wasn't my sister until, gosh, I think I was 13 years old, and I was having a fight with my mom, and it came out that my older sister was really her younger sister.
Wow. So. Are your siblings back in Namibia, or some in this country, or all in this country?
No, everyone's back home. I'm the only one here. I have a cousin in Dallas, but that's really it.
Okay. So back to your mom and books. I mean, I think you mentioned she was if I heard you correctly, a school teacher, at least for a time. Was she a reader herself?
Yeah. My mom's a huge reader. I'm a first generation student, so she didn't go to college, neither did my dad. But till now, I mean, she values books in a way that I don't really. I mean, she did grow up in rural Namibia. And I wonder, I mean, of course, that's probably why books are so valuable to her. So like I will write in the margins of my books and, you know, and because I get them readily, right? But even though she gets them just as readily as I do now, she has a deep respect for books. But yeah, she's a reader. She loves to read.
That's actually fascinating. There's a whole, well, you may know more about this now, but there's, you know, at least I know for U.S. history, like history of the book and transatlantic histories of the book, I know about a bit because one of my PhD mentor was involved in that. But that's just fascinating, the role of the book or even giving books to people, what that means. And I don't know if I remember the first time I wrote in a book, but really feeling like, oh my God, this is very transgressive. This is something I shouldn't do. Now I'm begging, you know, on my knees, students to write in their books, you know, if it's their book, right? Marginalia. Yeah. That's really interesting though. So your mom, what about your dad? Was he also encouraging your reading as well, or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I am my father's child and yeah, he absolutely encouraged it. I mean, he was an English teacher. He read my work. He was, he passed away years and years
ago.
And he was not a very talkative man, at least not when I was older. But I did notice like anytime I read a book, he would read it. So he wanted to know what I was reading and he was very interested in, you know, the things that I was, that he wanted to know what I was interested in.
That's neat. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. Those are gifts, right? I mean, not just the books, but the encouragement and the modeling. Were you going to private school or public school in high school? What was that like?
So yeah, Oranjemund, again, private school. So fantastic education. And then when I went to high school, it was public school. Okay. And there are reasons for this. So when I went to high school, it was after Namibia, of course, became independent. So after 1990, and my parents really, so the practice in Oranjemund was we were right at the border of South Africa. And we were like right on the very tip of Namibia. And so there was all this like emptiness before you get to the next like big town, which is Windhoek, that's in the middle of the country. And so what people did was instead of sending their kids away to the city, you know, to boarding school to get high school education, they would just send them into South Africa. Across the border, there's a little town right there. Huh. And so my parents didn't want me to go there because they didn't want us to have a colonial South African education. So we went to Windhoek. So
another gift from your parents.
Another gift from my parents, yeah. I think, I don't remember now, but I know a lot of the white students continue to go into South Africa. I believe Zara, my little best friend at the time, I think she went to South Africa for a time and then eventually they moved to Windhoek. But yeah, so my parents sent us to Windhoek and yeah, I went to boarding school there.
Okay. Yeah. And so was it, I mean, you have this love of reading from an early age. What were you at boarding school? Did you have majors? I don't know what it was like, or did you have strong interests at that point?
Oh yes. Yeah. No, I can't exactly remember. I know we were borrowing from the British system of education. So it was something, I can't remember what this stands for, but it was HICSE and ICSE. You could major in like natural sciences, or you could major in, I believe it was, I'm trying to remember if it was English. I majored in English, and then you could do it like, you could do higher education or lower. I don't even remember, but it was like a more intense focus or less intense focus. So, I mean, I like to read. I was good at writing and reading. Mm-hmm. So it was something that, I definitely majored in literature and English. And it was there actually that I read my first like African novel.
Well, that's literally what I wanted to ask you, now what you were reading. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. That's interesting.
I don't remember anything else that we were reading. I think we read some American literature, but the only African novel we read in that class, because and I don't know why this is the case, but it was Maru by Bessie Head. And I loved that novel immediately. Incidentally, I teach it, and my students, like the last time I taught it, they hate the novel, which kind of wounds me. And I'm going to teach it again this semester. And, you know, we're going to have a conversation about why they cannot hate it.
maybe they'll like it this time. Fingers crossed.
I hope so. It is like, I think what they didn't like about it was Bessie Head's writing. There's a lot of things she doesn't explain. And that's also part of, I think, a struggle in African diaspora literature, where authors talk about when you write in the West, you have to do a lot of explaining. You write your novel, you send it to a publisher. The publisher says something along the lines of, what are you talking about here? You know, explain, explain. And then like I'm writing an essay right now about this author, this Nigerian author, Sefi Atta, and her novel, A Bit of Difference. And she talks about when she goes to Nigeria, people come up to her and they say, I like it better when you write a novel here because you do less explaining. And so, and so I think with Bessie Head, there are things that I take for granted. Like I understand Southern Africa. And so the novel doesn't read as jarringly for me as it does for my students.
Sure.
And then there are things that she just doesn't really explain. Like, you know, 1 minute a character is doing something and then the next minute, she writes a sentence that says, and she, I don't know, and she went into the classroom. And my students are like, who's she? Is she talking about the character Dikeledi, or is she talking about this other character, Margaret? I mean, what is going on? Mm-hmm. So they have that. And then the story is also speculative in a lot of ways. Like, I don't want to like put a genre to it, but there is a little bit of like magic realism. Well,
that's literally what I was just thinking about. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm more familiar with that in terms of some Latin American literature. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and they don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't have known what to do with that either at their age. I didn't. I'm thinking of some things like, I remember when I read, first time I had to read Borges. Oh my God. I was like, what is this?
What was that?
I had to read Borges, you know, as an undergraduate. No, maybe as an undergraduate. I was utterly lost. Mm. Anyway, but one of the, you kind of touched on one of the questions is that I had for you. I thought maybe we'd come to later, but maybe we can do it now since you're touching on this, you know, are there certain traits of quote unquote African literature that they share? Is this, or is that too simple? Is that kind of flatten complexity?
Are there certain traits of African literature that?
Yeah. I mean, if I said to you, what are some of the, what distinguishes, let's say, African literature, if there's such a thing, even? I mean, even that term may be problematic from, let's say, you know, European literature or. Does that make sense? Are there certain distinguishing characteristics, speculative, not having to explain?
Yeah. And then, of course, like the use of the. What I would say African life worlds. And I think, and perhaps that's what my students are also picking up on, like what they're thinking of as a speculative, as magic realism. One of the characters, Maru, he thinks of himself as a god, and he does have these godlike characters, and people revere him and fear him. And they're not sure if it's real or if it's imagined. And I'm like, but that's kind of part of African life worlds, right? Those worlds aren't as separated as we like to think of them as here.
Right. Okay. But so, I mean, yeah, different, very different than Western. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, so there's you know, the question of what African literature is huge. Yeah. But the way I define it is I draw from this scholar. His name is Irele. And he writes about the African imagination. And the reason I like his definition of African literature is because it's also diasporic. But he's okay. Basically, he says, African literature, any literature that you can call literatures of the African imagination need to, are thinking about what it means to be African and Black in this world. So African and Black, you know, so drawing in the diaspora, they need to be, you know, drawing from oral literary or oral African traditions and African life worlds.
Okay.
And so that's another like important strain of this kind of literature.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
That's all helpful. And so so one could say there is African literature. It's not, but it's complex. These different distinguishing characteristics. That's a helpful definition even to me. Where is he from?
Oh, I think he was Nigerian.
He's Nigerian. Okay.
Yeah, he was Nigerian. Yeah.
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 But he's, so when you're in high school, I mean, at what point you're in the or boarding school? At what point do you know? How do you come to know? Want to go to graduate school?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Let's start with college. Let's start there with college first. Because first you go to Dallas, right? The University of Texas.
Yeah. So it's complicated, right? So
like African literature.
Yeah. And it was a long, long route to get to where I am now. Like with lots of,
Well, that's the stuff I love hearing about. So please proceed.
So yeah. So I did high school. I went to a Bible school in Windhoek, and I was living with my cousin at the time, and a friend of hers convinced me to apply to a school in Dallas, Texas, like a Bible school in Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
And at the time, I was actually thinking of going to South Africa. I wanted to just get out of Namibia. I've always had the sense of adventure. I kind of blame my parents because part of like living in Namibia is this migration. Every year, like clockwork, we go up north. You take this long 3-day drive and then you're driving along, you know, driving around in the north, driving back. So I love road trips. I love to travel. And so after high school, I was thinking, I want to go to South Africa. So he convinced me to go to Dallas, Texas. I applied to the school, got in, and then went to the school I was there for 2 years. Then I thought, well, I kind of want to know, because it was very much like living in a bubble.
Let me interrupt you if you don't mind. Is there a denomination to this school? And did you grow up in a religious family? Is Namibia mostly Protestant? I don't know, actually.
Yeah, Namibia is mostly Protestant, I suppose. Okay. I grew up, I think most Namibians would be Lutheran. I grew up Anglican.
Okay.
And we went to church every Sunday. It wasn't like religious in the way that people think of religious now. Like my parents, you know, my parents drank, had parties, you know, lived their lives. Right. And then you go to church on Sunday and then you go to Sunday school and all of that stuff. And there was, of course, an expectation, right? Like it is part of the imaginary to be a good Christian.
Right.
And Namibia is, you know, thought of as a Christian nation. And there's a history to that, is long and complicated and very colonial. But
was this Bible school Lutheran or what was it?
No. So the school was not. It was non-denominational.
Non-denominational. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you're there.
Yeah. And it was really missions focused. I had a good time. It was fun. As fun as Bible school can be. I made friends. And then I decided, you know, because I'm a reader and because I've always been curious, I wanted to know, like, I wanted to see outside of this bubble that the school like imposed. I mean, it was really conservative. So I applied to community college, got in, started going there, got a job and started working as well. And then when I was done with community college, I applied to the University of Texas at Dallas and got in and started my degree in literary studies. And then after about, 3 years, really close to graduation, I mean, really close to graduation. I wasn't, at this point in my life, I was, yes, going to school, but I was going to school because it's what people did. You know, I'm an immigrant and, you know, you don't come here and mess around. You come here and you get an education and you support your family back home, whatever that means. Not that my family was not doing well, but it's just the way things work. You figure out how you're going to help with the family back home. So I went to school. Did literary studies because I like literature, not so much because I was really looking for a career. I've always struggled with like trying to pin down what it is that I want to do. And I mean, at some point, my parents sent me to a therapist, like a career counselor person. Yeah. And so, and it didn't help. So I went to UTD. It was expensive. I was paying international student fees.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right.
And working two jobs at the time. And so I just decided I couldn't do it anymore. And I dropped out, got a job working at an events like / flower shop company. It was a flower shop.
Oh,
but they did like high-end events. And it was so much fun. It was a lot of hard work. But it was like in a really, it was in Lover's Lane, Dallas, you know, high-end part of town. I mean, we did a Super Bowl party once and Usher was right there. I mean, I don't do, like, I'm not a fan person at all. I'm not, you know, big on popular culture, but I knew who Usher was. And I kept trying to, like, get closer and closer. And then his huge, like, security person was inching closer and closer to me. Like, you're not getting anywhere near Usher.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. It was a fun job. I mean, we got to really hard work. But I can make you anything out of flowers.
Oh, I just made a note. Believe me, I love flowers. I'll be asking at some point.
Yeah.
So you had actually dropped out of UTD?
I dropped out of UTD. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then go back though, right? Because you finished your degree there. Yeah.
Yeah. So at some point I'm like, so long story that I won't get into here. I did get tired of living in Dallas. It is a sprawling, city.
Yeah. And been there just once. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I moved to Oregon and decided to go back to school to finish my degree. And at this point I was thinking, well, I hate to leave things unfinished. I want to go back to school, finish my degree. And then I wanted to set up my own like business of some kind, see if I can actually make something out of this, you know, years and years of events and flower shop experience. Probably would have failed. I don't have a brain for business, but that's what I was thinking. And so I signed up so the way it worked was I contacted UTD and they said I can take like 3 online courses with them and I can take 3 courses at the University of Oregon and I can transfer those to UTD and get my degree that way, right?
Oh, so that's interesting. What I did. Okay.
Yeah. And so that way I could say I graduated from UTD. And so I did that. And while I was at Oregon, I took a class in the English department called Theory. And I can comfortably tell you that at that time, I thought I hated theory, but it was the only class that worked with my work schedule. And I was like, okay, I can do this. It was a summer course. I can power through it 1 month and then I'll be done. We read all these different kinds of theories. The teacher was amazing. And we're still friends. And then we read post-colonial theory. And it literally changed my life, opened up the world to me. So here are literary scholars who are asking the questions that sort of niggled at the back of my mind since Namibia became independent. And since, you know, I'd been like going to school and studying literature. And basically these thinkers were like looking at literature and asking about the post-colonial condition. One particular essay that I remember was by Edward Said. Mm-hmm. And he writes this critique of Jane Austen's novel, Mansfield Park.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know the critique.
And basically, the question he's asking is like, okay, so here are these people. So Mansfield Park was published 1800s, early 1800s, I think it was 14. And basically, you know, it's Jane Austen. So they're living in these huge estates, you know. And he was like, where are the Black people in these stories? You know, they're invisible, right? And he says, well, the Black people are on the plantations. They're working as slaves. They're the people who are sort of, you know, generating the wealth to support this lifestyle. And that was eye-opening to me because I've loved literature. I told you my mom taught me to read like early on. And as I worked at the flower shops and in these events companies and throughout like my years living in Dallas, I'd always join these like little reading groups. I have friends who love to read. And inevitably, always, always, always on the list of books to read was Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
Of course.
So, yeah, my reading groups were white, mostly. So Pride and Prejudice makes its way there, or we'd watch a film based on Pride and Prejudice, something.
Yeah.
And inevitably, I mean, we're sitting there, we're reading the novel, we're also drinking. So inevitably somebody, one of the women goes, "Oh, Mr. Darcy." And Mr. Darcy's, of course, the protagonist, the protagonist, the guy she loves.
Yeah.
Mr. Darcy's so handsome. Oh, the tall, dark and handsome type. What would it be like to live in that era, to have men who treated you that way, to wear those dresses? And at that point, when the conversation would inevitably turn to that direction, I would get a little uncomfortable because I would start to think, well, what would it be like if I ended up in 1814,
right.
Where would it be? And I didn't see myself. So I would just be sort of quiet, right? And, so these literatures that, like this post-colonial theory was like, these people are asking those questions that sort of sat in the back of my mind. And the tiny like racist encounters that I had as a child, like with my little friends, right? I mean, I had I tell students about this, not because I want them to feel sorry for me and think that I suffered or whatever. I just want them to get a sense of like the way ideology works, right?
Right.
I had a friend of mine. It wasn't Zara. I don't remember which friend of mine this was. But she said to me at some point, we're sitting together, I believe it was in Tank Park, just hanging out. And she says to me, and she's white, and she says, "It's such a wonderful thing that we came and colonized you. Otherwise, you would be living," and I'm paraphrasing, "pretty much living in savagery." Wow. Now, at this point, I'm like, what, 7 or 8 or however old I am, I'm a kid. And I know this isn't quite true because I have a sense, I mean, I know my grandparents, I have a sense of my own cultural background, but I didn't have the language to sort of address that kind of racism.
Right, yeah. You wouldn't say, "I don't like your ideology," or you speak,
right,
exactly.
Right.
That's age 7.
Yeah. Here's the disturbing thing, right? My friend wasn't being offensive. She loved me. And she was like, "Oh my God, we did this wonderful thing for you."
Yes, yeah.
So, and so I tell my students this because I want them to get a sense of like the way ideology works. It justified colonialism, but it also justified this paternalistic, problematic attitude, right? And racist attitude.
Right.
And so here are post-colonial theorists, and they're giving me the language to talk about these things that happened that I saw happening as a child.
That's liberating. That's kind of a liberating feeling.
And then I was just like, I have to go to grad school. I have to like find out like what actually happened, in Namibia that justified colonialism. And what are Namibian authors saying about the Namibian literary condition? Because, I mean, at this point now, I'm aware that African, you look at novelists and novelists are commenting on the nation, commenting on the post-colonial condition. I wanted to know what Namibian authors were saying. So that's kind of how I ended up in grad school.
It's such a great story because, you're a professor, you know this as well as I do. So many students seem to think they have to have it all figured out
way
in advance. But no, the way it doesn't always work that way. In fact, my sense is it usually doesn't work that way.
Usually doesn't work that way too.
Yeah, that's my experience. I guess that wasn't true of me. I kind of went to college, was a history major, went on to graduate school in history, kind of linear. But for so many people, there are these roundabout, indirect. I mean, what if you hadn't, I don't know, what if you hadn't gone to Oregon, right? I mean, who knows? And you must have had some professors, and maybe they're all white professors, I don't know, encouraging you to apply to grad school?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the professor who taught me, his name is Corbett Upton, a wonderful person who taught that class on theory, actually told me, "You should go to grad school." And I laughed at him because I was like, why? I mean, at that point, I was curious enough and I was thinking I could investigate this stuff on my own. But then we did an independent study together and we dug deeper into it. We actually focused on Namibian literature and he kept bringing up grad school. And I was like, I don't know. And I thought, why not? worst case scenario, you know, a few years go by, it's not like I, you know, and I postpone the whole business thing.
You can always open up a flower shop another time. Yeah.
Best case scenario, it like sort of, it feeds into my fantasy. I've always thought, one day I'm going to become a novelist, right? You know, I don't know. I think a lot of English professors have that dream.
Yeah, but that's kind of...
Best case scenario, I come out and I'm a writer. Turns out I am a writer, just not what I thought I was going to be writing. But.
Yeah, but you are a writer, definitely. It's so interesting. It's wonderfully interesting. And so what exactly was your dissertation about?
So my dissertation was on Namibian women's writing and particularly digital literature, basically. So it feeds out of this question that kind of led me to grad school. Like I wanted to know, so Namibian women writing in the context of nationalism and let's say the post-colonial condition. So when I went to grad school and wanted to find out like what Namibians were writing, I found that really there weren't a lot of novels and not many that were written by women. And when I asked around in Namibia, like, and I asked my friends, I'm like, where are the novelists? What novels are you reading by Namibians? I was basically told, well, Namibians don't really read novels and they really don't read literature. They read biographies and historical texts. And I was just like, no, that's you. And this is what they write. And I was like, no, that's not right. Because I went to boarding school in Namibia, in Windhoek, and there was a rich like literary culture, you know, amongst us in that boarding school. I mean, we were writing poetry. I was writing terrible poetry and short stories. And I had friends who were artists. And then there was this like secondhand bookstore that was down the street, Uncle Spike's. It's still there.
Great name.
Yeah. And so we'd go down to Uncle Spike's. We'd exchange books because he would allow you to like exchange books and not have to buy anything. And we'd take him back to the hostel or the boarding house. And basically how it worked was, let's say I'm reading a novel right now. Sarah would come up to me and say, hey, when you're done with that novel, can I read it? And I'd be like, no, well, ask, you know, Dapewa, she asked me first. So there'd be a line of people waiting for this novel. And so I'd give it to the next person and then I'd get my next novel from whoever was reading whatever, you know. So we were just passing these novels around and talking about them. So I'm like, there's no way that could have just died down and led to nothing.
Right.
And so one of the places I started finding women's writing was in anthologies and like these collections of by feminists who were doing like writing as activism. So going into like the rural parts of Namibia and getting women to write because they wanted to write, but what they needed to do was make space for themselves to write. So negotiate the space with their families so that they could have this moment where they could do something that they loved. So I was reading those works. I was reading a collection that brought together women's writing, like fragments of women's writing of their experience of the war in northern Namibia. And I found this beautiful short story that I just loved that was about Namibian nationalism from the perspective of women. So that collection formed maybe the first part of my dissertation.
Okay.
And then the other part of my dissertation was digital literature, like Facebook fiction. And I stumbled across this. Like I was on Facebook one day, my cousin was, you know, I was on my cousin's page and she'd liked this page called The Dream of a Kwanyama Girl.
Oh yeah, which we talked about before we started recording a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And so I looked at it and it's a story about this girl, this young woman who goes, it's a page, a Facebook page, and it's episodic. So chapters are released, you know, whenever the author decides to release the chapters and then the readers read them and comment on them. But it's a story, it's a Jim goes to Joburg. So it's a like a South African trope about a person who leaves the rural area and moves to the city. So here, this young woman moves from the rural areas to Windhoek to go to college, to the University of Namibia, to become an accountant, basically. And so she comes to the city and she has all these, you know, various experiences. It is melodramatic. It is addictive.
I had never heard of Facebook literature or in that title of your essay, serial fiction. I didn't know it existed until preparing for this conversation. But sorry to interrupt. Yeah. So it's melodramatic. It's lyrical. It's addicting. You said
addictive. Yeah. And it has thousands of followers. And so that was the thing that gave me pause, because I was like, okay, if I'm wondering where Namibians are writing, because it turns out, like, that was the first one I found, and I went digging and I found, you know, so many other Facebook authors who are writing these stories and have these thousands of followers who are reading these texts, who have been writing for years. And the readers are commenting on the story, you know, dedicated, careful, critical readers, you know. So if Namibians, you know, are writing, they're writing in these digital spaces. And if I'm looking for readers, here are the readers, right? And it's an interesting writing, because normally you pick up a book and it's just you and you read the story and the author is nowhere in your imaginary, right? You're reading the story, you're by yourself, you're with the characters.
Right.
On Facebook, you know, the characters might also be, you know, it might be told in diary form. So you're not sure if you're reading the author's story or the character story, but it doesn't matter.
Yes.
The author is commenting on the comments in the comment section.
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
Story. Yeah.
And it's much more interactive, obviously. And you're reading fellow readers' comments,
right,
too.
Right. And shaping the story based on what your readers are seeing, right?
Absolutely, it's fascinating.
It's playing out, you know, in real time, like you can see it happening. So, so it led me into the field of digital literature. So I started with the Facebook fiction and now, you know, online literary magazines. Turns out this is the direction that the African literary tradition is going anyway, you know, into these digital spaces.
Which is extremely interesting and not something I ever would have thought about. Is this Facebook serial fiction, is that unique to African literature? I mean, I assume not, but I don't know.
Yeah, this is something I need to look into. I don't think so. Okay. But I think a place will form a digital literature based on the infrastructure. Like in South Africa, they have blog fiction. Like these kinds of literatures and this interactive form happens in blogs. But in Namibia, blogs don't work because Facebook is way more accessible. People have, you know, Facebook is easier for Namibians to use for some, you know, for various reasons. I know that there was a Facebook literary thing happening in China. Somebody's written about that. So yeah, I'm sure it's happening in other places. I don't know to what magnitude it's happening in these various places, and I'm talking about African literature as though Africa is a country. Africa is not a country. It is a huge thing in African, in particularly Southern Africa. So I know that people who write Facebook fiction in Namibia are also reading literatures by people in Malawi and Botswana. Okay. So there's a definite transnational exchange happening there as well.
Now, you were looking at, for the dissertation, looking primarily at women doing this writing, correct? Is that right? Women writing for this Facebook literature?
Yeah, women or gendered focus. So the Dream of Okanyama, the Dream of Okanyama Girl is anonymous. I thought I tracked down the author for a second there, but I'm not entirely sure this is the author, because the other problem with these digital spaces is plagiarism.
Sure.
Yeah. So people are constantly stealing other people's work.
Yeah.
But the focus of that particular work is gender dynamics in Windhoek and the treatment of these kinds of women, these young women who come to the city and they dress in a particular way. They've become known as Kandeshis. So she wears a miniskirt, she has a weave, you know, she has a boyfriend who buys her things and then she drops him and she finds somebody else, you know. It's very critique, like, you know, is your girlfriend a Kandeshi? Is one of those questions that, you know, popped up when this was becoming a thing. But that kind of rhetoric, and it's something I write about in my dissertation, that kind of rhetoric is conservative and it privileges patriarchy in the sense that you're not looking at the fact that there's an expectation, right, that women behave in this way, like whether or not they want to. You can't walk down the street in a miniskirt and a weave and people don't think of you as a Kandeshi, or men particularly.
Right.
The other side of this is that, you know, impossible expectation for women to be chaste and pure and, you know, all these things in very specific kind of ways that aren't really realistic. And so that wasn't part of the conversation at all. And so I was thinking about the connection to this kind of traditional, and I put traditional in scare quotes because it means so many different things, but this kind of traditional expectation that kind of comes down from trying to define women's position in the context of Namibianness. So if you are a Namibian, you know, or if Namibia is a nation, that nation is both modern in the sense that it adopts, you know, the stuff that comes with nationhood, modern nationhood, statecraft, etc. But there's also the other component that is cultural. And so in, you know, you have the traditional authority that determines like how things are run in like the rural areas. But then you also have women who must also, you know, embody this kind of tradition. And so what does that mean for young women? Problems, if you look at the dream of a Wakanyama girl, because they want to come to the city and they want to have fun, but they can't express this kind of fun without it being read in particular and problematic ways.
Right. That's, it's not traditional Namibian womanhood or I'm sitting here smiling and shaking my head. It just sounds absolutely fascinating. I can think of some interesting parallels too. I won't get into them here to the US, and I'm sure other countries.
Oh yeah.
About this is, I wonder, so is this Facebook literature now, you know, talking about Namibia, if you're able to tell, I mean, is it primarily women readers or not?
No, I don't think it is primarily women readers. Okay. I mean, the readers, yeah, there are a lot of women, but there are also a lot of men. So I can't exactly say, you know, the weight of it. I know it's personal. So for example, I follow this, woman, she writes in the, her page is called Angie's Comfort Zone. She is probably one of the most prolific writers that I've seen on Facebook so far. And she's got a huge following. She's a policewoman in Northern Namibia. Wow, and she writes, I don't even understand where she finds the time to write as much as she does. And has a huge following of both men and women. And I suspect a lot of them, I mean, it's Facebook, right? So it's personal. Yeah. They're your friends, you share your page with your friends, they share their page with their friends. So there's a community component to this. So, and yes, your coworkers that follow your work as well. So yeah, I don't think I think it's personal, and it's, you know, I think it also depends on like your friend circle.
It's so fascinating. I'm thinking about how, like, you know, reader response. I mean, of course, some of the, I suppose you can't always know who's, even if there's a name, is it the person's actual name, male or female, but just being able to see in real time responses.
Yeah.
I find that, you know, because we can read reviews. I'm thinking of books in the US, let's say books written in the 19th century, but it's hard to find unless you come across a diary, maybe, or a letter where someone's mentioning some book they read. I just find it extremely interesting. And I knew none of that until getting ready to speak with you. Your current work, let's talk a little bit about that, which is, it's hashtag shut it all down, right? That's what you're currently working on. Tell us a little bit about that, what that involves, that work.
Okay, so the journal Feminist Africa, which is probably the premier journal on gender, women, feminism on the African continent, they put out a call for papers, was it last year? A year ago, like 2021.
Okay.
Asking for people, scholars who want to write about 21st century feminist movements on the African continent. And I put in a proposal because Shut It All Down happened in 2020. So during the pandemic, happened in Namibia, and it was after the killing of a young woman, which happens quite a bit in Namibia. And it just became like, it happens a lot. And at that point, when this young woman, Shannon Wasserfall, goes missing, people have had enough. And so, and there was a confluence of things, right? I mean, on the one hand, another woman goes missing. It's COVID, so the police is having a hard time focusing on this because of all they were banning traveling and, you know.
Sure, yeah, all the pandemic stuff.
Yep. And her parents, what was different about this, this particular woman, is that her parents kept her in the media. Well, in September, her body was discovered, and it erupted into this movement that swept across Namibia. I was watching it on, I was here in the United States. I was in Oregon and really following it on Twitter and Instagram. And so just trying to find out what was happening, you know, where, you know, the call for, you know, for people to show up, the government's response. And then this magazine that I follow, Sister Namibia, and what they were saying about it. And so when the call for papers came out through Feminist Africa, I was like, I want to look into this. And I want to particularly look at how activists were mobilizing images, you know, because I mean, I studied nationalism, right? And in the context of literature, but I was seeing it playing out like in the symbols that were being deployed by these activists, you know, one of the signs that was, you know, really prominent. And of course, this movement was documented also in the West. Like, I think like European magazines picked it up. I don't know if any American magazines did or not. It was also happening in conjunction with NSARS that was happening in Nigeria. It was a year of protests. So anyway, so yeah, I wanted to look into that. And so I started this research project, and it's actually been a lot of fun in the sense that it's stretched me a little bit. I had to do interviews. I've never had to do interviews before.
Oh, I wondered about that. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
And have made friends as a result.
Yeah. I mean, you're not just reading. you're interviewing.
I had to go to Namibia and talk to people. And you know, it turns out, you know, it was, and I tend to think of myself as I don't like to do that, but it was fun. And I made a friend. She's a journalist, Hildegard. I invited her to my class last fall.
Oh, I saw that on your CV. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so she came and talked to my class. She's actually doing amazing work on Namibia's colonial statues. And she had there was a statue in Namibia, Kurt van Francois statue, the supposed founder of Windhoek. And she had that eventually after 4 years of activism. They've taken it down. But she has like she's spoken to his family. I mean, he's German, but of course he had a Namibian, I believe it was a Namibian wife or mistress. There were some children, and these ancestors are still alive. And so she, you know, she's interviewed them and has this whole history. And it's amazing. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's amazing. The stuff around. I'm just on Monday in my first class, my Civil War seminar, talking about monuments, Confederate monuments and Union monuments and, you know, what comes down, what should come down, if anything. It's global, right? It's not just
it's global.
US. Yeah. I had not heard of this movement until preparing for this. And it just sounds really, really, and that's also, I mean, as you say, year of protest, not just, well, in Namibia for sure, but So is the idea, what's the plan? Is it to do an article, submit something to this journal? It sounds like for sure. Right.
Yeah. So basically it's a consortium of scholars who are working on these movements. And I want to say 12 research groups. Or 12 scholars.
That's neat too, collaborative.
Yeah. So basically people working on various movements, right? I'm working on Shut It All Down. There are people working on movements in South Africa, in Nigeria, in, you know, somewhere in East Africa. So people from everywhere. And so it's a three-year project. The paper that I just wrote is the first paper. It's actually, we're meeting next week in Ghana, except I'm not going. So it's going to be 3 a.m. in the morning for me, 9 a.m. in the morning for them. It's going to be fun. But yeah, so we're meeting to talk about, you know, like our writing, and then we'll revise it. And it's basically, it's a series of three articles that you're going to be writing.
It's fantastic. Congrats on that. It sounds really, 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 yeah. both the way it's being done, the collaboration, and then also just the subject matter itself, extremely interesting and important. I'm just impressed, you know, I'm in my head, you know, very old fashioned notion of comparative literature. I mean, the way you're looking at digital, which I think you said, if I heard you correctly, it's kind of, you think is the future of sort of African literature, or not just Namibian, right?
No. It's across. Yeah, digital. It's the future. It's happening now.
Yeah. That's extremely interesting to me. Yeah. And then the way you're working into your teaching, and I want to turn to the teaching now in the time remaining. You've got this is your. You have a year and a semester, right? Under your. belt, so to speak.
Yeah.
What are some of your impressions of Gustavus and Gustavus students, and also being a faculty still few faculty of color on a mostly white campus.
Yeah. Gustavus has been wonderful. I'm not going to lie. The students here are impressive. They pay attention. They do the reading. I'm very demanding. I don't think of myself as demanding. I come assuming that they've done the reading and they don't fail me. And I'm thinking about myself as a student at their age. I don't know if I would have been as great of a student, but yeah, they come prepared. I've heard that Gustavus students don't like to talk, that they're reticent. Right.
That's what they're, yeah.
And for the most part, I haven't experienced that.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Yeah. So my students are, pretty chatty. And my classes are run like a discussion. And my students come with their
questions. Same here.
Yeah. So my experience here has been great in terms of like teaching. As a faculty of color, it would be nice if there were more of us.
Of course, yes.
I think I'm probably struggling a little bit more with living in St. Peter and not seeing enough people of color than I am at Gustavus.
Right.
I feel very supported by the college.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I sometimes think, what would it be like? I remember just what my wife, Kate, and I, she grew up in New York City. I grew up kind of in Chicago. We met in Boston, but that was culture shock enough. Mm-hmm. And so I often wonder, my God, what it was like to be, and my wife's, maybe I mentioned Jewish on top of it. So anyway, it's a different, it's a different kind of world.
It is a different, yeah.
But, it's also, I agree with you about the students. It's funny. That's a lot of people will say that about our students. And another word I hear people who don't teach at Gustavus, but come and visit, they use the word earnest. Our students are earnest. And I think there's some truth to that. We're generalizing. Yeah. Not all students do all the reading all the time, of course. Yeah. They're students. But for the most part, you can walk in and know they've read and have a meaningful discussion. Yeah.
Right. And they're genuinely curious. I haven't met any, I know people encounter disrespectful students. I have not met any of those. The students come to class, earnest is a good word, they're as excited about the material as I am. I mean, I teach my research.
Yeah, you do. You're lucky. That's fantastic. Yeah.
And let me say something about this fantastic English department that I'm part of, that it allows me to teach my research. I'm very grateful. So I feel very deeply about the things that I'm teaching, and I feel like they appreciate that, and they are perhaps not as excited as I am, but definitely excited,
Yeah, that's good. Excellent. Well, your work is just absolutely fascinating to me. I'm sure to the students too, and your colleagues, it's really great. Mm-hmm. There's so much. I mean, one of the things I love about this podcast is just how much I realize I have to learn. That's incredibly humbling, but also kind of exciting at the same time. And I mean, I know virtually nothing about, I know nothing. I mean, except what I've learned from you really about digital literature. Facebook now I have I used to have only negative feelings. Now you've helped me have some positive feelings about Facebook. So
Feelings about Facebook. So I get those negative feelings. Incidentally, my students don't care about Facebook. So we're looking at Instagram stories. So.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. That's holy cow. This is awesome. Great. That's so cool. All right. Well, Martha, this has been so much fun and a real pleasure. You love coffee. I love coffee. We meet at River Rock now and then. Yes. We'll do it again. I know. We're up here in the Twin Cities. Yeah.
And I'm going to come to the city so we can.
Please do. We can explore. Go wherever you want. Yeah. I don't know. There must be some Namibian people living in the Twin Cities.
Yes, there are. There's actually a decent Namibian community that lives in the cities.
Really? So, okay. Yeah. You can teach me about that. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
We're kind of in a, Somali neighborhood or sort of a Somali neighborhood where Kate and I live downtown. It's really been fun, really fascinating. Good luck with all the stuff you're doing. And I didn't even get into all the service you're doing for the college and professional service. That's a whole nother. That's another podcast, but I think maybe less interesting than research and teaching. So take good care. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah. I'll see you around campus.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
I agree. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.